Okay, this is the hour we'll take your phone calls, maybe your paranormal stories as well. Let Stephen get a take on that for you. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Stephen Browdy with us. Stephen, what has been your methodology when you test either individuals or test just about anything to determine its paranormal abilities?
I wouldn't say I have just one methodology. It really depends on the nature of the phenomenon I'm looking at. So I wouldn't test the gold leaf lady quite in the way that I would have tested the Kai. I mean, in part because the gold leaf lady worked in broad daylight. And she wasn't really working. This was something that just happened to her. It was an affliction. I've just come back from Argentina, where I was studying another PK subject who's quite promising, also works in broad daylight. He can raise tables, not fully levitate them, but he, unlike Kai, he's thoroughly cooperative and works in light. And he's submitting himself to various kinds of experimental methods that are similar to those that were used 100 years ago with certain mediums. For example, it was found in the late 1800s and the early 20th century that when tables levitated, the medium's weight increased by the amount of force needed to raise the table. And my colleagues in Buenos Aires rigged up strain gauges that they placed under the subject, whose name is Ariel, and also under the table. And it's very helpful for Ariel to look at the readouts on a computer screen from the strain gauges. He can see when the table is starting to get lighter, even though it hasn't yet lifted off the floor. And he finds it very helpful for raising the table even further.
Now, when people have these psychokinetic abilities, how far or how high can they move an object? Are we talking about inches, feet, you know, a block? How far can they push this thing?
Interesting question. I don't know. We don't know the limits of that. And it may depend on the belief system of the people involved. I know many of my friends, or some of my friends, I should say, have had experiences where they've had table turning sessions where the table has walked upstairs, out into the street, and so on, things like that. I know people who've seen tables levitate to the ceiling. Ariel has been instructed by my colleagues in Buenos Aires to keep the table raised only about an inch off the floor. And they request that because they think that's actually the hardest thing to do, that the initial lift, if psychokinesis is a force-like process, their reasoning is that to get it initially off the floor and keep it there requires the greatest amount of force. Once it's up, once it's aloft, it doesn't take as much to make it rise even further. It's that initial lift that's the hardest. So to keep it at that low level is, they think, more of an achievement.
Have you heard of people levitating themselves?
Well, yes, sure. I know you had Michael Grosso on the show not long ago. Well, the case of Joseph of Cupertino is one of the great ones. I wrote about that in Limits of Influence. The Flying Friar.
Yeah, that's a great story.
It is, and probably the best evidence for human levitation that we have.
It's just amazing that this happens through this other kind of realm that we have. It's not just through the mind. It's something else, I think.
You may be right. At this stage of my life, I find that I become less and less satisfied with metaphysical explanations of any of these things. I think we really haven't a clue what's going on. I mean, theorizing is almost as easy as lying, you know? Theorizing well is much harder, but there are lots of theories out there, and I don't know how we really tell the good ones.
Let's take some calls here for you, Stephen. Let's pick it up by going to Mary in East Los Angeles. Good morning, Mary.
Hi. A friend of mine died. And she used to hang out in our garage. And she, I believe, opens that garage door every so often. Huh. And sometimes, like the day before her funeral, I had to wake up and write a poem about her. And right after I wrote about the breaking glass, And right after I was done, 20 minutes later, the glass from the church broke to kind of say, hey, you know, I'm here. And so I think sometimes telekinesis done casually by the spirits is believable. You know, maybe going up and down with a levitated table is a little too formal for the people that I know that passed on and are trying to speak through me. And I don't know, sometimes it scares me. Sometimes I think I'm crazy. I don't know what to do. What do you do about that?
Well, I don't know what you do about that. If you mean by how do you make it go away or how...
I don't know that I wanted it to go away. I mean, lately, I think Robin Williams is telling me things to do, and it might help me, you know, get a career. I don't know. It's like if God was the Holy Spirit, help the Bible can't come through. What's wrong? Why is this considered bad? You know,
I think it is. I'm not sure who considers it bad, but if I had to put my philosopher's hat on here, I'd have to say that while I don't doubt for a moment that phenomena like these occur, and they've certainly been reported for centuries, actually, it's almost impossible to know what the origin of the phenomenon is, whether it's coming from your deceased friend, whether it's coming from you who would like to hear from your deceased friend somehow. I mean, there's no way really to tell. It's not as if we can go around with a PK meter and see where the force is coming from. We just don't know. That's why it's so frustrating to investigate this phenomenon.
Stephen, have you come across people who read or see auras?
Auras?
Auras around your force field.
Well, yes, I know people who claim to do that. It's very interesting ability. I don't know what to make of it.
Different colors and everything else.
Yes, and of course the different colors are supposed to be associated with different aspects of character.
What would you say of everything you've investigated seems to be for you the most fascinating aspect of all of this? What really gets you?
Well, I just can't shake my interest in macro PK. And, you know, in part it's because psychic phenomena are so difficult to investigate. Controlling them is so hard when you can't really be sure what it is you're chasing after, when we don't even, you know, trying to bring psychic phenomena into the lab may almost be a premature thing to do at this point. You know, if we study memory, for example, in the laboratory, we can do that to some extent because we have some idea what memory's function is in real life. We have some kind of real-life acquaintance with memory and the natural history of memory phenomena. But we don't have a clear picture of the role of psychic functioning in everyday life. We can speculate a lot about it, and God knows we do, but we don't really know what we're bringing into the lab. We don't know whether what we're trying to bring into the lab is totally inappropriate for bringing into the lab, you know, like trying to study sensuality in a laboratory context. We're, you know, in any sort of formal laboratory situation, we're straitjacketing human abilities. And most interesting human abilities can't be studied in the lab.
I used to practice PK, and I could never move anything. But I would stare at an object, Stephen, for hours, thinking I could just push it with my head, my mind, and I couldn't, just couldn't happen. Yet some people can do it so easily.
What the big unanswered question here is whether we can do these things unconsciously when we're freed from all our normal resistance mm-hmm. constraints. And I don't think we have a real firm handle on that either. And as we noted earlier, you know, one of the reasons I think so many people are probably subconsciously frightened by PK is this very idea that, you know, since we all have nasty thoughts about people, who knows whether those nasty thoughts could actually have an effect? We don't want to be responsible if we have an evil thought about somebody and then that person has an accident.
Or they die or something. Yeah.
Yeah, right. But that, I think, is what's at stake if we allow... if we open this Pandora's box of allowing PK into the world.
Well, and you know what they say about karma, too. If you wish evil things, doesn't it come back to you five times as bad?
I'd like to think that there was a kind of cosmic justice, but you have to wonder. There are some people who seem to be pretty rotten who do very well.
They've been very lucky, haven't they, so far?
Yes.
Let's go to Dan in Monroe, Michigan, east of the Rockies. Hey, Dan, thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, George, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I don't know if you heard about the guy this weekend that killed a bunch of people in Kalamazoo.
He oh, yeah.
Sure. Uber driver.
Yep, sure did.
Anyway, he got a phone call, according to a passenger, before he started driving all erratic. And I was wondering if I haven't heard anybody say anything about mind control, but would somebody be able to activate somebody through mind control?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Like that call was do it now, or they gave him a code word or something, and he freaked out. It's a bizarre story because he had no police record. He was married, had a couple kids. It's bizarre. But can you trigger somebody like that, Stephen, mind-wise? Can you hypnotize somebody to a point where you call them and trigger them with a word?
Well, there's no question that post-hypnotic suggestions can be extremely effective, and you can get people to do things like that. Whether that's what happened in this case, who knows? Who had access to this guy? I don't know.
Brandon in Pleasanton, California is on with us now. Go ahead, Brandon.
Hi, I was working in a vacant building that was being remodeled, and I could hear this noise behind the door. So I finally opened it up, and the lights turned on. So I'm looking around, and then I saw on the wall, there was like a computer hanging on the wall. And the wires for the mouse and the keyboard were going around wildly for like 15 minutes while I'm there. Finally, I left the room.
Jeez.
It just kept on moving like crazy.
Were you doing it, do you think?
I don't think so, because I never been in that room. I didn't know they were even in there.
Huh.
And I went to like other rooms before I came back, and I could still hear this noise. So, and then I have another comment. It's like, you ever notice, like, you look at someone's back of their head, and some people, like, turn around right away.
You want them to turn, yeah.
Actually, the only one in the train just glance, and they turn around.
Yeah.
They know you're looking at them.
They
right
can
away.
Feel your eyes. I used to try that experiment in school, too. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. I think I spent all my time in school, Stephen, experimenting. But we've all done that, right? We've all concentrated on the backhead of somebody saying, turn,
I think,
turn.
Yes.
You know, sometimes
I
just by
had much more success than you.
No, and you know what? Process of time. Eventually, they're going to turn, and then you think, "Hey, I got it right. It worked."
Yeah, right.
It's something else. Gary in Santa Maria, California. Hello, Gary.
Hi. Let me give you my take on a theory as to why mass consciousness works.
All right.
It has to do with their final discovery of a tsunami-sized gravity wave at the LIGO installation. It's verified. They exist. It was huge. Two black holes 30 times the size of our sun, or the mass of our sun, colliding 1.3 billion years ago, that they now measured. It lasted for about a fifth of a second.
In our Milky Way galaxy, I guess, right?
No, this was outside of.
Really?
Yeah,
in the galaxy.
It was inside the Milky Way galaxy because it was only 1.3 billion light years. They estimate.
That's
hard
right.
to estimate that, but anyway, our your dowser that you had on that did the water taste change experiment,
Mr. Grace,
really put me on to it. And this audience has been through quite a number of intention experiments with you and other hosts, Lynn McTaggart, Dean Radin has spoke. I spoke to both of those people on there a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen Schwartz really did some testing on it. We're made up of water molecules, and dark energy directly interacts with gravity waves. Dark energy is what holds everything together. We have more water, hydrogen, and oxygen on this planet than we do anything, including in our minds, in our bodies. The little experiment that I would propose, that I guess you're still game for, that's soothing over an active sunspot, if we're, in this case, fortunate enough to get an active one.
Yeah, it's been pretty quiet lately.
Well, we got about 2 weeks, but I'd like to time it astrologically when Mercury, Chiron, Ceres, Neptune and the Sun all move into Pisces. And I would have a little glass of water and have you lead the audience in a little sip and see if we can quantum entangle ourselves through the dark energy and then just put soothing thoughts out to what would be a sun flare and see if we can quell it with those planets in Pisces with Jupiter directly at our back.
Wouldn't it be a better, Gary, wouldn't it be a better experiment to see if we can get it to throw off a flare?
Yeah, and what happens if we get an X-43?
Well, then I can tell people I told you so.
Well, the Carrington event, you know what happened the very day before Carrington?
What happened?
Check it in the history books. We dug our first operational oil well. And maybe somebody said, oh, you're digging for energy? Here's a demonstration of what real energy is.
Well, you never know.
One sun flare equals the entire output of planet Earth, electric-wise, times 100,000. And the Bible says over and over, look to the heavens for signs and signals. Look to the heavens for signs and signals. Look at Fatima, drying all of the people's clothes, 17,500 people. Look at the Fatima lights, where it was predicted that the Aurora Borealis would light up on cue, on demand, from the Virgin Mary. And when I called in the last time, I was joined by your other four frequent callers, and then Cornelius a day later, and that one sun flare, 2497, popped off 30 times like an AK-47 after that.
Well, we'll do that experiment, Gary, when the time comes, I guess. The power of the mind, Stephen. It's big.
It is. I don't understand what it has to do with gravity waves, but
Gary,
no doubt about the power of
Gary
the mind.
Gary thinks that we can control sun flares with the mind. He claims that he has recorded every time there's an event with a flare. So I told him we'd go ahead and do a mind control experiment and see what happens. You never know.
That would be interesting.
You never know. So of everything you've studied, you would say PK is the most fascinating in this field?
Well, I'm interested also in the evidence suggesting life after death. Because I'm, you know, more and more chronologically challenged.
As we get around the home stretch, we want to find out, right?
That evidence is also extremely fascinating, but also extremely frustrating. It's very difficult to, at least for me, given my own philosophical scruples, to reach the kind of firm conclusion that I would like to get. I mean, I'd like there to be absolutely conclusive evidence for an afterlife. I don't think we have that.
I don't think we'll get that.
No, I don't. Not until the time comes.
What about witnesses, though, who see ghosts and, you know, dearly departed loved ones? Isn't that evidence?
Well, yes, it's evidence, but whether it points conclusively to an afterlife or to something else, I mean, it could be a kind of psychokinetic process as well.
Well, that's true. It could be. Stephen, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment with final questions here on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen's websites are all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. His latest book is called Crimes of Reason. We'll be back. On our next Coast to Coast program, pharmacist Ben joins us for a couple hours from criticalhealthnews.com, followed by our open lines on Coast to Coast AM, and we're going to come back and take your final stories and questions with Stephen Browdy next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Stephen Browdy with us, of course. Stephen, can we call you Dr. Browdy at all?
Well, you can if you want. If you want to use a title, I prefer your lordship.
Or how about king?
Okay, that's good.
I love it. So let's talk about life after death for a moment, then we'll wrap things up with final calls.
Okay.
What do you think it is? By now, you've come to some of your own conclusions, I'm sure.
Well, my conclusion so far is that if there is life after death, we don't have evidence that everybody survives. At best, we have evidence that some people have survived. And we don't have evidence that those who survived survive forever. The evidence, such as it is, at best, I think, suggests that some people survive for a limited time. That's probably not what you wanted to hear.
But no conclusions, really.
I can't. You know, it depends on what day you ask me. Some days the evidence seems very persuasive to me at a gut level. I mean, if the question I and lots of scientists want to know is whether there's rationally compelling evidence for life after death, the kind that we would expect of any sort of serious scientific investigation. It's too hard to do. And the reason is it's almost impossible to rule out counter explanations in terms of psychic functioning among the living.
All right, let's take some final calls here. We've got Claudia in British Columbia. Go for it, Claudia.
Hi, guys.
Hi there.
Your lordship. And
thank you.
George.
And me, little old me.
I'd like to compliment both of you on a beautiful interview tonight. Well done. George, before I ask Stephen his question, one of my favorite guests on your program in years past was Sean David Morton, and I wondered what happened to him, and then I looked it up on the internet, and when you find out that they're engaged in unscrupulous activities, maybe fraud, you know, it's very disheartening, because I'm with you on that one. Like when you were talking about when you went to that seance and you weren't quite sure if it was
the real deal
or not.
That's
yeah,
right.
There's so many people out there that are on the fence and they like to believe. And I think sometimes they stop looking or they stop sensing because of actions committed by people who are their frauds. And that's a bad thing. It makes things more difficult.
Well, it muddies up the waters for good investigators and people who are trying, that's for sure.
And for people who are genuine, because I know they're out there. And, Stephen, I've seen videos on the internet on some of these Tai Chi masters and Qigong masters who are able to push people right across the room with their hands. You know, they send out the Qi energy. Have you... is it for real? Have you investigated anything like that?
I have seen those as well, and I haven't had the opportunity to investigate any such people under the kind of conditions I would like. That would be a great thing to do.
Yeah,
it's funny you should mention that. I'm actually pursuing investigating somebody in China who does some very interesting stuff.
Great. Well, then I hope George has you back on the show.
Oh, of course.
Because you guys did a beautiful interview.
All right. Thanks, Claudia. Appreciate it. What are some of your colleagues and friends say, Stephen, of your research?
I mean, as opposed to my former friends.
Yeah, exactly.
There are still some who tolerate it as a kind of eccentricity, but aren't willing to really go down that path with me. And, you know, I don't force that on folks. But most of those who've remained my friends understand my interest in it and feel I do a responsible job at it, and they're with me.
Are they stick by you?
They have so far. I keep testing it.
Now, back to our German friend, Kai.
Yes.
The medium. Do you keep in touch with him?
Well, not since our last visit to Germany, when he learned shortly thereafter that I would be publishing the full details of the discovery of his fraud. I feel I have to do that just out of scientific and moral obligation to put the facts out there. Kai is spinning this as though I'm trying to ruin his mediumship, and it's really not the case at all. I'm actually one of his biggest supporters in the face of serious questions that Kai is responsible for raising in the first place. If Kai hadn't cheated, these questions wouldn't be coming up. I've urged Kai to do what, you know, prominent people often do when they're caught in some sort of public scandal. They apologize, they show some contrition, they admit that they made a mistake, and they move on. And I think Kai could do that. I don't think this has to sabotage his mediumship if he's willing to give up trying to be an all-purpose spiritist guru who never has a bad day. I mean, the problem with Kai is that his seances are virtually the same time after time after time.
Mm-hmm.
Enlarges his repertoire, but then he repeats the phenomena over and over.
Is he getting attacked now on other fronts?
I think he's been attacked all along. I've tried to defend him against some of the more unfair attacks. Unfortunately, now we have reason for some quite genuine and justified attacks on his credibility. But I'm still there for him. I think some of his phenomena are indisputably genuine, and I wish he'd stick to those and not try to be a guru to the community of spiritists, because he's not.
Okay, back to the calls. Josh is truck driving in Louisiana, east of the Rockies. Josh, good morning.
Morning, gentlemen. How are we doing?
Good. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, so I got a story. I want to share it with you guys. I was actually trying to call it in the other day when you're looking for scary stories, but this also fits right in with the story.
All right.
Good buddy of mine, we'll call him Ethan for the name of the story. He believes himself to be a medium, and he always held all these seances and everything, and I just go with him for pretty women. I really didn't believe in all that. And then one day he begged me to go to this one. He found out about a family that just curiously died. Yeah, their beds, just like their souls were just took from. And he believes something spiritual happened in this place. It was this big seance. I went into it, and he offered beer, so I decided to go. So we're there about an hour, hour and a half into it. He's, got about seven people with him besides himself. And he set up pentagrams, little alchemic circles and everything. He's doing his little chant thing. And
yeah.
I'm actually starting to fall asleep. You know, I'm bored of it, bored of tears of it. The next thing you know, he's talking to me, but it's not him. It's like his spirit version. He puts his hand on me, tells me to wake up. But I come to, it's dark in there, yet it's still light outside. I see all the rest of these people kind of freaking out. I see Ethan right in the middle of these pentagrams here, almost in like a Chris Angel-type position, almost like levitating, but not. They can't talk to him, can't get him responses. I walk over to him. I put my hand up. And I've never felt anything like this. It's like the dead cold is what his skin felt like. It actually singed the hair on my hand.
Wow.
I mean, it scared me to death. And all of a sudden, we all hear a voice. It says, "Welcome, Ethan. Your soul is mine."
You think he's the real deal?
Well, after this, yes. I never believed in any of that till this. And what had happened after that, this young little girl was with us. She was trying to open a sliding glass door. I was scared. I said, "That's my exit." I actually ran through the glass or busted the glass, which wasn't a good idea, but I had to get out of there. I ended up with glass on my back, so I rolled and hit the ground. I look up and I see her. I'm screaming, "Come on, let's go, let's go." And I've never seen a look of panic on anybody's face like this in my life. As she put her hand on the pane of glass, I just went.
Wow. Scary times ahead, to be sure. It's amazing, Stephen, how some of these mediums really either put on a good show or they're doing the right thing.
It's true. And unless I know more about the conditions under which it all occurred, it's hard to know or make even a decent guess as to which of those things is going on. One of the things the caller made me think about was, I told you about the subject in Argentina I was checking out recently. When he makes tables rise by touching them, his hands and arms get very cold.
Like they're dead.
They're not that cold.
Good.
But, I mean, almost as if it's suggesting that the energy is leaving his arms and hands and going into the table and doing the work.
Out of 10 mediums, how many are the real thing, in your opinion?
Whoa. Probably the majority are...
I'd say one or two might be real.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Pretty low. Pretty low. But the good ones are good.
They are. They always have been.
And the good ones don't want too much, you know? They don't charge people exorbitant prices or anything like that.
I'd be careful about that one, George, because it depends whether the medium has anything else going for him or her. You know, there are some who have no other really marketable abilities, and it's the best path for them to a decent life. But that's a double-edged sword, because that's exactly the situation that can all too easily seduce certain mediums into cheating when the power is not there.
To put on a better show.
Right.
Tim in Phoenix, Arizona, west of the Rockies. Tim, you're up with us. Go ahead.
How you doing, guys?
Good.
Hi. Well, I called about, I was going to talk about my two favorite mediums, Edgar Cayce and Jane Roberts, who channeled Seth. And then I was on hold. I was thinking about a story. You're talking about telekinesis, right? I was working in a fine dining restaurant, real hard flatware, and Uri Geller came in. And Uri Geller, I was a waiter, and he bent this really hard flatware.
He's good.
With his finger.
Yep.
Now I'm thinking, you know, did he have like something in his pocket? You know, there's theories that he's cheated, right? But he wouldn't come in a restaurant to do that. We handed him the fork, and that thing bent. You couldn't do
like rubber.
Yeah, you couldn't move it with your hands. Like I said, it was hard English flatware.
Yep.
So I see what you know. Just see what you think about those things.
I can see. I can bend a key with trickery. And you can't bend it in your own fingers. It's impossible. I mean, you could pull as much as you want. You can't bend it. But I can do it with the right key.
Yeah, but what about a flatware of, you know, he's like that?
Let's bring Stephen in on this. Stephen, I know Uri Geller. I think he's the real deal. He froze up on the Johnny Carson show a long time ago. But what do you think of him?
Well, I think Uri's the real deal, too. Whether he's sometimes not the real deal, maybe, I don't know. But there's no doubt in my mind that he's got what it takes, at least some of the time.
You know, I want me to tell you the secret of how you bend a key?
Well, I know there are some, but what's your secret?
All right, you get a whole bunch of keys. You got to go to the store and do this because you don't want to use keys from somebody's real collection because you might screw up their ability to get in the house or something
right.
like that. So you get all these keys, but you have to get a key that at the base of the key, there's a hole there where you can slip in another key from the other side. Okay. And so what you do when people aren't looking, you've picked out a key is you will put the front part of the key, the little skinny part, in the hole of the other key and squeeze it. You just, it's just like a wedge, okay?
Yes, right.
And then you take the key you've bent, and then you pretend that it's straight. It's easy to do. And you keep rubbing it like Uri does. And then you keep pretending that you're bending it back and forth like a piece of rubber. And then hence, it's already bent, and you just show it. You bring it out real slowly, and it blows people's minds. It's a great little trick.
And it's one of the reasons why the best cases of physical mediumship, or PK, are those that can't be so easily dismissed by appealing to various tricks of sleight of hand.
That's right. That's absolutely right. We've got Adam truck driving in Florida, first-time caller, and let's get him in here. Go ahead, Adam.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Good, my friend. Drive carefully, but go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Got a question for your guest, Stephen. I had a sister-in-law at age 14 passed away in a car accident, and ever since then, been wanting to see a medium. Me or my wife has never seen a medium before, and we've been told by numerous people that to not do it, that seeing a medium could open up a can of worms, and You could wind up having evil spirits around you then or something. I just wanted to see what you
had. I wouldn't worry about that. But, you know, first of all, go to a good medium. And there are two places I would send people to. And one would be the Forever Family Foundation in New York. And the other would be the Winbridge Institute in the Southwest.
Could you find good mediums there, too, that would visit you?
I don't know if they make house calls, but the Forever Family Foundation can probably put your caller in touch with a good medium. I mean, both places, the Forever Family Foundation and Winbridge, certify mediums, and I would trust them.
Dan in St. Louis. Got a minute left, Daniel. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning, good evening,
morning.
Whatever it is out there. They say we only use half our brain, right?
Sometimes, yeah.
At best.
Just think what we could do if we got to use our whole brain.
Oh, my gosh. Be better than a computer.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you, guys.
Okay, short and sweet.
Yes.
Stephen, what's up next on your plate? What are you working on?
Just writing some papers and trying to spend a little more time making music now that I'm retired.
What kind of music?
I'm a jazz pianist.
Well, good for you. Good for you. Do you play around Vegas?
Not as much as I'd like, but if listeners are curious, just go to my website, jazzphilosopher.com.
Is it a hobby that you've turned into an avocation or what?
No, I've been playing professionally since my teens.
Oh, that's great. That gives you that rhythmic mental self, that discipline.
Balances me out, yes.
It really does. Well, okay, Stephen, good luck to you. Keep in touch. And Crimes of Reason is available where?
Through Amazon, certainly. Probably not at your neighborhood bookstore.
You would not find it there?
Probably not.
Did you have fun writing it?
Yeah, I have fun writing all my books. It's kind of exquisite torture, right?
Favorite chapter, what is it?
Whoa. First chapter on memory.
I like that. It works. Okay, thank you, Stephen.
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you. See you under a full moon.
You got that right. And it's the snow moon, at least last night. Great full moon if you haven't had a chance to see it. Perfectly round and perfect. It's something else. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.